Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. And a beautiful Shabbat it is. We're privileged as a synagogue to have sister congregations nearby that we relate to in a very wonderful and mutually helpful way. And today we're privileged to have Jared Eaton, who assists his father, Rabbi Tony Eaton, in leading congregation Simchat Yisrael. And we're just so privileged to have him to be with us, and Ingrid, his wife, and John David, their son. So let's welcome Jared Ruach Israel style, shall we? Why not?
So thank you so much for inviting me to Ruach Israel. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Jared Eaton. I and my family are visiting here from Congregation Simchat Yisrael in Connecticut. But I practically grew up here at Ruach. You know, I spent so many weekends here in this temple on youth events with Dave and Julie and Dan and Joel. So it feels like a second home to me, and I'm very honored to be here with you today. So as I said, I am from Simchat Yisrael, and I just got a new job title. So I was the rabbinical intern, but the internship ended, and now I'm the assistant congregational leader, and it's a little strange. I'm not the rabbinic intern like Nathan over there, and I'm not the assistant rabbi like Nathan over there. So I'm like, if Simchat Yisrael was like the Star Wars universe, Rabbi Tony would be Obi-Wan Kenobi, and I would be like, what's that guy? The guy with the lightsaber, the blonde hair, and Chewbacca. I'm sorry, I have to start with a joke. It relaxes me before I have to speak in front of a crowd. Most people do not like public speaking. For most people, standing up in front of an audience is their worst nightmare. Not me, though. I love it up here. See, I know all of the rules. See, I know that I can drop my voice, get a little more conversational, talk to someone in the front row. Hey, what's going on, man? And then when I look up, we all feel like we know each other a little bit better, right? I know I can raise my voice to a crescendo and let silence hang for 3 seconds. And speak quietly and firmly and know that I have all of your attention. I do not suffer from stage fright, but I do suffer from anxiety. See, people don't believe me. How can you suffer from anxiety, Jared, when you're so comfortable speaking on a stage? Well, see, the problem is I'm only comfortable speaking on a stage. No, it's true. Wait, okay, you guys, we're going to go into that on Nick's Place later, and you're going to talk to me, and I'm going to be like this really awkward dude, and I'll struggle to find like appropriate topics of conversation. Like, I'll talk, but it's be good stuff. When I'm nervous, I'll say things like, I love your hair, is it real? You know, I'll probably let my wife do the talking for me because she's the opposite of me. She hates public speaking, but she's like, 30 seconds, she'll be your best friend. I suffer from anxiety. This can come in many forms and varying degrees of severity. I don't have it so bad that I can't function, but for example, I don't know what to do with my hands most of the time, and I'm terrified of the telephone. So what are some other examples? I've heard people enjoy Sundays. I've even heard them referred to as fun days by 80s pop bands. For me, Sunday is the worst day of the week because from the moment I wake up, all I can do is just worry about the impending doom of the next day when I have to go back to work. Anxiety for me is a little like a little fire that burns in the back of my mind that gets hotter and hotter and hotter as I'm worrying about some deadline I need to meet, and it keeps burning me until the task is completed, and then I have a brief moment of relief. But then the flame just finds the next thing, and it just starts burning again, and it never goes out. And this is the problem with anxiety. See, we tell ourselves that the reason we're feeling bad is because, well, life is just stressful right now. I can't find a job. I have overdue bills to pay. Terrorists have taken over my office building, and I have to crawl through the ductwork to pick them up one by one. But if I can just push through these hard times, I'll feel better when my situation improves. But see, right behind that fight is another one. Once we've gotten past one bad situation, our anxiety fixates on something else, and the death by a million cuts continues. So, there's this famous quote by Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, Kol ha'olam kulo gesher tzar meod. All of the world is a very narrow bridge. It's in a single sentence, Reb Nachman just sums up all these feelings of anxiety that plague us as we walk through the world every day. One wrong step to the left, to the right, and we go plunging down into the precipice. By the way, I recognize the irony of making you anxious about your anxiety levels, but if we don't figure out how to manage this, it will kill us, literally. See, most people don't know this. Anxiety is the number one cause of death in America. If you count heart disease from eating to relieve anxiety, smoking to relieve anxiety, using drugs and alcohol to relieve anxiety, suicide to relieve anxiety, stress and anxiety is what is killing America, and nothing else is even a close second. In the last decade, prescriptions for antidepressants have gone up 400%. Rates of depression are up 800%, and strangest of all, across the board, from drug therapy to sitting on a couch and talking to a psychologist, antidepressant treatments are getting less effective over time, as if we are breeding a new strain of medication-resistant anxiety. Now, it makes sense, right? I mean, we're having these problems. Well, obviously, why we're having these problems. If you picked up a newspaper, turned on the news, we just saw that horrible shooting in Florida. We're going crazy because the world has gone insane. We're anxious for a reason, right? Well, yes and no. Well, we're anxious for a reason, but I'm going to argue that it's not for the reason that you think, and it's not because the world is worse. So I like thought experiments. So let me give you a silly hypothetical situation. Okay, I'm a crazy inventor, and I invented a time machine, and I told you I could send you on a one-way trip to any point in history in any place in the world. The problem is I'm not a good time machine builder, and my machine doesn't work very well. So I can send you somewhere, but it's going to be a one-way trip. I can't bring you back. And the other thing is the controls are, they're set on random, and I'm not sure where or when I would send you. Now, hypothetically, you don't have a family or close friends or any job you're attached to. So would you take this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to live a completely different life? Would anyone take me up on this offer? No, I wouldn't. What if I end up in Europe during the bubonic plague, or like in Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge, or any time before the internet was invented? How would I live? See, the thing that nobody wants to admit is that the quality of life is objectively better today than it has ever been, ever. And yet we are more scared and depressed and over-medicated than we've ever been. So I have a friend, and I knock on this guy all the time. He's just this very interesting case study. So this guy, if you were to look at his life from the outside, he seems to have it all. He's got a beautiful wife, a baby, a nice condo in a great neighborhood. He's got 3 cars, all of them paid off. Very lucrative job with tons of benefits and security. He and his wife make more than enough to live very, very comfortably. He also has in his basement an arsenal of weaponry and ammunition large enough to conquer Sri Lanka, and he fully expects to have to use it one day. Not in Sri Lanka, but, you know, just in general. So if you were to ask this guy if he was satisfied with his personal life, he'd absolutely say, yes, things are going really well for me. But if you asked him if he was satisfied with the country he lives in, he'd yell at you for an hour about how the immigrants are taking all the jobs, the people in the inner cities are going to rise up and attack the middle class, the Democrats want his guns, and he pays too much taxes. See, my friend, he's an extreme case, but I think that overall he is very representative of America. What his case tells me is that this country is full of people who are overall happy and satisfied with their own lives, but are constantly bombarded by the fear that they could lose it all in an instant. And it's not an accident. Because your anxiety is making other people rich, and our whole society has geared itself towards keeping you at a low level of constant fear. See, anxiety is not a bad thing. We feel it for a reason. Anxiety motivates us to act. If we open our refrigerator and we see that we have nothing to eat, we feel anxious because it's almost dinner time. So we go out and we buy food. and the anxiety subsides. That's healthy. That's how it's supposed to work. The problem is, modern mass media has figured out a way to hack your anxiety instinct. I'm sure, no. Anxiety is a tool that is meant to keep us alive. So the finishing touches were put on our brains tens of thousands of years ago. So back then, if you were feeling anxiety, it's because something dangerous was happening to you. Your fire was about to go out, or you're about to be trampled by a woolly mammoth. Our circumstances have changed a lot since then. The world has changed a lot since then. Our brains haven't. We live in a world that's too complex for our minds to truly figure out. Listen, if you're not good at math, is anyone here not good at math? It's okay. Your brain was never built to do math. It does not come naturally to anyone. Don't let anyone tell you different. Human beings as a whole are terrible at understanding abstract concepts and ideas. If you don't believe me, go watch someone play the lottery and try to explain probability to them. See, the problem with this is that our brains, on a chemical level, react to abstract threats the same way it does to real concrete ones. Let me repeat that. This is important. Our brains react to abstract threats the same way it does to real ones. So, if you see a story on the news about a home invasion that happened in Los Angeles, where four people were murdered, the dog was set on fire, they shot the baby out of a cannon, you know, it doesn't matter if there was a random crime that happened on the other side of the country, and the other 300 million people lived in relative peace, your brain is going to experience the same fear reaction for a threat that if you were facing a charging mammoth. See, fear creates an imbalance in your brain that can only be equalized by action. Real life tragedy actually galvanizes us. So when our houses catch fire, we spring into action. We rescue our family. We start throwing fire water on the fire. It's the opposite of anxiety. But when you see that same fire on the news, there's no action you can take that would make that any better. The closest thing you can do to relieve that stress is to click that link to the story, or buy that newspaper, or watch that news broadcast, and the media knows it. Sex doesn't sell. Fear sells. It's not just the news either. So the media fear cycle is most obvious about it, but advertisers use the same instincts against us to sell us products. So I'll use a personal example to illustrate. From the time I graduated college through most of my 20s, I was a little overweight. But it happened so gradually that I actually never realized that I was fat. See, I didn't feel unattractive. I had lots of friends. I had a pretty girlfriend. I was healthy. I was actually pretty athletic for my size. I call that being acrophatic. I never felt like there was anything wrong with me. Every time I turned on the TV, I was being told that I was a disgusting monster. And not only was I repulsive, I'm also hilarious. Everyone is laughing at me. If I was a character in a movie, I'd be the guy who tripped and fell through a wedding cake. See, all of a sudden, I was being told that something that had never bothered me before and never affected my life was something I should be ashamed of. And the only way to make it better, to relieve that anxiety that they put me in, was to buy their products. I needed to join their gym. I had to buy the right kind of food. I had to wear this kind of shoe to get in shape. So I lost the weight years ago. But I'll tell you honestly, I feel fatter today than I did back then when I was heavy. I obsess over nutrition labels at the grocery store. I feel guilty every time I eat a potato chip. Apparently, I've been eating gluten all these years. That makes me a terrible person. What is trans fat? When did that become a thing? See, the news media uses overt fear-mongering, but advertisers use a much more subtle and pervasive form of it. They create anxiety in us by showing us an unrealistic image of the world and telling us that it is the only acceptable way to live. And they're very clever about it. So, okay, imagine, you turn on the TV. You've all seen this commercial before. You know, this is a young, stressed-out couple, and the dad's kind of a bumbling goofball, and the mom's this harried mess trying to juggle her career with the kids, and then the house is in chaos with the kids running around, and oh no, the dog fell in the pool again. And the overt message that no one ever falls for is that whatever product they're selling, yogurt or paper towels or whatever, is going to fix these people's lives. No one buys that. But the insidious message, the one that gets in your brain, is what's going on in the background of these commercials. So the message is, don't be like these two jerks. Meanwhile, this idiot dad and the harried mom are living in a $900,000 house in Fresno with two beautiful new cars in the driveway, and their biggest problem is a dog jumped in the pool. What this tells every 20-year-old who sees this ad is that if they don't have a big house and two cars and balance a career and children and get to the gym for 2 hours a day to look like the mom in the commercial, then that means I'm a failure as a human being. And this niggling sense in the back of your brain that you aren't doing life right follows you your whole life. Even the way you relax is subject to scrutiny. So remember, like, the acceptable way to relax is to travel, to drink wine. And if I tell people I have a few days off from work and I'm planning to stay home and watch wrestling all day, you know, they're going to pity me, because that's not how cool people relax. The whole world is built around keeping you in a state of unrelievable tension. It's like a wasp buzzing around your ceiling 24 hours a day. And they tell you that you need to make lots of money, but you also need to make lots of time for your family. They tell you that you need to be fit and in shape, but cool people eat and drink whatever they want. You need to dress a certain way, but you shouldn't care about appearances so much. Well, they don't want you panicking. That would mean burning cars in the street. That's not profitable for anyone. They just want you scared enough to go watch that next ad, buy this next product, click on this link, watch that episode, and it's killing us. The news media takes all of the world's problems, problems I can do little to nothing about, and puts them on my plate. So now I'm afraid of crime, not because I'm in danger, but because deep down my brain can't distinguish the difference between real problems and made-up ones. You know, I just bought my son a little Beta. My brain's kind of like that Beta. He's like a fighting fish, bashing itself to pieces against a mirror, unable to tell that the only one I'm fighting is myself. And if you put all this together, you can have a person who lives in a middle-class neighborhood in central Wisconsin, who has plenty of food and clean water, who has access to medicine and security, who wakes up every morning terrified of ISIS and of transgender people, and of North Korea, and additives, and vaccines. And this isn't how it's supposed to be. We are the body of Messiah Yeshua. We are not supposed to be afraid. We have been called upon to trust in the Lord, to know that He is our strength and our shield, that He makes our path straight. But it's hard sometimes when the whole world is howling in your ear to be afraid, when those hornets are buzzing around your ceiling, when that fire in the back of your brain just won't go out. How can we be still and know that He is God? See, I focused a lot on the 21st century today, but modern America doesn't have the market cornered on anxiety. See, even back in Yeshua's time, people were stressed out and afraid and worried about things that they couldn't affect. When people brought their fears to Him, this is what Yeshua told them. Yeshua told them, do not worry about life, what you will eat, nor about the body, what you will wear. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn, yet God feeds them. How much more valuable you are than birds. And which of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? So if you cannot do something, even very little, why do you worry about other things? So do not seek what you will eat and what you will drink, and do not keep worrying. Instead, seek His kingdom, and these things shall be added to you. Now, these are beautiful words, but this is more than just poetry. In this short teaching, Yeshua is actually breaking down a 4-point plan for dealing with anxiety that is effective today as it was back then. So, let's just go through it step by step. Step 1, don't sweat the small stuff. So I discovered this interesting fact while I was doing some research on this sermon. Are you guys all familiar with the task manager on your computer? You hit Control-Alt-Delete, and it tells you what percentage of the computer's energy is being used on a specific process. So if you were to look at a task manager for the human body, you would find out that 30% of the calories that we burn every day are spent on the brain alone. That's a lot of energy. You would have to jog at about 8 miles an hour for over an hour just to burn the amount of energy that your brain uses every single day. So what are you using your 30% on? Do you burn that energy worrying about your lifestyle or on only eating organic vegetables? Are you thinking about your body image, whether your clothing's fashionable? The energy that our brain uses is a limited resource. You only have so much of it. So when something tries to grab your attention and get that stress reaction from you, be it a Facebook post about some issue, or a news article about some new threat, recognize that they are stealing something from you. Don't let them do that. Your attention is yours to give, not theirs to take. Yeshua is telling us, tune the voices out. Shut the computer down. Put down the smartphone. Turn off the news. Don't worry about the things that the world demands that you worry about. Now, why is that? Because of step 2. God is going to take care of you. There's this great advantage that believers have over people who haven't found the Lord yet. We have a wonderful and tremendously effective way to deal with anxiety. We don't have to hold on to it or fight it or bury it. Instead, we can surrender it. If there's something stressing you out, you can always give it to God. To a God who loves you and he wants you to be happy and healthy. And the great part is, once you've prayed about it, you are not allowed to worry about it anymore. It's actually a sin to keep worrying about it. This is God's problem now. He's going to take care of it for you. So is Yeshua saying that just sit on your butt all day long and don't let God worry about paying your rent? No, not at all. Yeshua is saying, if you can't affect it with action, don't give it your energy. See, rent is perfectly okay to worry about. So you can do something about that. This is why God created anxiety in the first place, so you'd be motivated to take care of yourself. What's not okay is to worry about stuff you can't affect with action. No amount of worrying is going to add even an hour to your life, so don't waste your 30% on it. So I made a simple diagram here that about how Yeshua wants you to approach your problems. If you can fix your problems with action, then by all means, that's what you should do. But then let it go. So if the candidate you don't like said something that made you mad, don't vote for him. But don't bring it to work with you. Terrorists blew up an airport in Turkey. Donate to the victims. But don't be afraid to fly to Florida to visit your mom. If there's nothing you can do about a problem, then it's not a good use of your 25%. Or 30%, sorry. So let's see if we get this. If you have a report due at the end of the week, and you might lose your raise if you don't get it in on time, what should you do? Yes, fix the problem. This is why anxiety exists. Okay, if someone is trying to shame you about something you have no control over, like your height or your race or your big nose, what should you do about it? Don't worry. It's out of your hands. Don't give it your energy. If someone is trying to shame you over your weight, which you can control, but you're happy with the way you look, what should you do? Don't worry. Don't worry. They're the ones with the problem, not you. Don't worry about the things that aren't worth worrying about. Instead, seek God first. Your attention is a limited and precious resource. Use it for what matters. Give it to your family, not the world politics. Give it to your friends, not articles linked on Facebook. If you give these things your attention, they will give you nothing but anxiety in return. But if you give to God, he will give you peace. So, in conclusion here, Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav said, "All the world is a very narrow bridge. But the second part of that quote is, the important thing is not to be afraid. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Please, O Lord, our God, may the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, may the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may the descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those. Know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.